My name is Bernard Guerra, and I'm your host of the Apartment Investor Series podcast, where I provide an in-the-trenches look at the multifamily real estate market. I have been fortunate for nearly 25 years as a broker to learn from and witness what super successful apartment investors have been doing with their investment properties. This podcast highlights how the experts are maximizing their multifamily investing. Let's get started. We're here with Dave and Tom Moore, the owners and founders of Equity Advantage in Portland, Oregon. And you guys have been, first of all, welcome. And great to see you both. I've talked to you individually and met with you individually in the past. I don't think I've ever been together with you at the same time. So it's a real treat.
Actually, that's funny, Bernie. Now you say that. I mean, we've been working together for probably several decades, but I really can't remember a time when the three of us were sitting together in a room. So
yeah, you're probably right. It's kind of like everybody wondering why they didn't see Bruce Wayne and Batman in the room at the same time. You know, they wasn't sure you both existed. Well, great. Well, let's just dive in. You started in 1991 providing 1031 exchange services. So I want to avoid making any assumptions that listeners know exactly what a 1031 exchange is and an accommodator is. So can you just start with a basic and give me a rundown, give us a rundown on what you guys do?
I'm going to let Tom do that.
Yeah. So we, as a 1031 accommodator, we refer to ourselves as a facilitator, really, because we take a very active role in helping people to determine, first off, whether they need to do an exchange or not. 1031 exchanges have been around since 1921, so over 100 years now, and they allow for people to essentially give up one property and use those funds to acquire another property and defer taxes in doing so. And in the, I guess, traditional sense of a 1031, you would find a property that's owned by somebody else, and maybe you like that property and the owner likes your property, and you swap deeds. Mm-hmm. That rarely ever happens in the real world, and the facilitation business, accommodation business, really came about and didn't get real popular until actually when we started in 91, when all of the final regulations were issued. And we now, with us involved, you can list your property for sale on the open market and find a buyer for your property and sell it like you normally would. We jump into that transaction, we turn that sale and a subsequent purchase of replacement property into an exchange for you to allow tax deferral. And you know, there's certain rules behind it. You've got time periods, time constraints in the exchange, and if you're looking to defer all of your taxes, you need to use all the cash to buy something that's roughly of equal value or greater. But great flexibility in types of properties you go into and also numbers of properties you go into.
Right. And obviously it's important to have a good accommodator, but you know, do you have any horror stories of people that got and had problems with doing 1031 exchanges?
Through an exchange, the exchange company perspective, or just exchangeors,
or any of that? I mean, we could all, I guess the first question is, are all 1031 exchange combinators created equal? And, you know, why is it important for somebody to have a good one?
Well, I think, Bernie, like I sort of joked with you about, we'd never been in the same room over the 20 plus years. I just, you know, with anything today, I think when you're so much of the stuff, and as we're talking about seminars in person or on webinars, you know, people don't really get face to face with each other that much anymore. And it doesn't really matter where you are. I mean, what we do is not a regional thing. We work with people all over the country and ultimately all over the world. And I just sort of feel like when we're going into times or in times like we're in right now, when I'm checking out a company online, I always go to that About Us page. And it always blows my mind how somebody, you know, this company will be over 100 years experience and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, well, you got 20 people with 5 years. So mm-hmm. you've got nobody in that group that has any experience with a bad time, right? So,
right.
So I think, you know, do Tom and I have stories of exchange companies that have had problems? Yes. And you know, I guess the big fallacy with that whole thing is people think, well, yeah, use us, we're huge. Everybody's going to sell what they feel their strength is.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just look at, you know, currently, I mean, what happened a couple of weeks ago, Tom and I were at a charity event that I'm on the board for, and you know, we're up on Mount Hood. And, you know, the Friday before the event is when the Silicon Valley Bank had the problem. And we're getting mm-hmm. emails Sunday night from one of our banks saying, hey, you know, we understand if you're you know, sort of uneasy at the moment, but this is why, you know, you're safe with us, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when somebody has a problem with a company, I mean, I think right now doing business with anybody, you better be working with people that have been through a bad time. And you know, somebody might have been in the business, but if it wasn't their business, they don't have any history or track record, right? So, mm-hmm. I mean, my perspective is work with companies that have been through, you know, survived the test of time and have the stories to tell about it. In our industry, I mean, the biggest guys are side corps of major corporations, and they have to have a side corporation to handle the exchange. Otherwise, mm-hmm. they'd have agency relationships. Tom mentioned earlier, you know, really the you know, most of the growth in our industry happened after 91 when the final regs came down. But, you know, the biggest failures in our industry were title company related. It's not the little guy. Now, we in our region had a couple failures. And typically the failures are a result of you know, poor management or bad policies. I mean, mm-hmm. either they're working with a bank. The largest failure was Land America. And they had investments they were told were liquid, which were not. And so when the market tanked, they didn't have access to the funds to get the deals done. You know, a failure closer to home was you know, a company out of Bend that had, instead of putting the money into bank savings accounts, which is, by the way it has to be today, if mm-hmm. anybody that's in this industry and treats it professionally, is going to be part of the Federation Exchange Accommodators. They have bonding requirements, E&O requirements. And you know, they require that the funds are put in FDIC, you know, bank accounts. But the failure, the regional failure here was because the exchange company wasn't putting the money in the bank. They were putting in the Path of Progress dirt, mm-hmm. and the market turns, and one, you can't sell it, and two, you know, the values go away. So it's really a situation where understand, you know, who you're working with, and you know, that longevity in the business is going to be the biggest telltale. But, you know, even in today's world, I mean, you've got instruments and, you know, Tom works, you know, I'm working on the you know, more of the marketing and sales side. Tom's running all the operations of the business mm-hmm. and, you know, we're blessed to have each other. But, you know, so, I mean, he deals with people's inquiries on the banking more often than I do. But, I mean, the reality is, you know, the money has to go someplace, and you've got to be comfortable that it where it is, and that you have it covered to the best of your ability. And
mm-hmm.
so that's the biggest thing. Tom, you have any comments you want to add there?
Oh, no, I think you covered most of that. I was going to say, as far as we're concerned, one of the, I guess you asked about horror stories. I think that the when we get phone calls, people calling into us, you know, the last thing that we want to hear from somebody is, yeah, I closed escrow on my property sale. Mm-hmm. What do I need to do now? And, you know, that's, we still get too many of those. And
right.
since day one, when we started in 91, we have really tried to take an educational approach and be out there in front of, and David's the main guy that does this, but to be out there in front of, you know, the real estate profession, the accounting profession, attorneys, you know, all these different professional groups that have anything to do with real estate transactions, and just putting the word out there. Anytime this property is listed, you know, find out, is it something you can exchange? And if so, contact us. Doesn't cost anything to contact us. We spend, you know, we spend half our day every day on the phone consulting people. And a lot of those people are not doing deals with us. But if you don't do that, then you know, you're going to be behind the game. But I had a guy the other day who has done several transactions with us in the past for over several years and called me up and said that he just closed on a deal and was ready to get into the identification phase. And we didn't hear from you. We don't have anything set up for this and it's too late. So he blew that deal.
Yeah, well, at least.
And to Tom, yeah. Bernie, to Tom's point, I mean, I always like to say the only dumb question is one that's not asked. And our father used to say, you know, anytime you read anything about something you know about, you know how wrong it is. So there's just so much misinformation out there. And something that's, you know, for example, right now the market's tightening. So we're seeing more seller carries. If you type in, you know, you Google search seller carry on a 1031, it's going to, well, you can't do it. Well, that's totally wrong. You can. There's five ways to do it. The other thing that's happening is, you know, back to what Tom just said, is that people are doing transactions where, and the seller finance comes up because the financing blows up for the buyer and the seller still wants to get the deal done because they've got a buy side somewhere else happening. Uh-huh. Right. So you got this short term sort of gap finance that has to happen, or somebody's got a property out there and they want to do, you know, they want to close on it. And then something happens, their sale, because the buyer's, you know, once again, the financing blows up. So now they're in a situation where they have to buy first and sell later. And so somebody just says, oh, yeah, you can do a reverse exchange. So they close on it and then they call us. And you know, like Tom said, it's like you cannot. If you close on something, whether it's a purchase or a sale, it's too late if it's not structured as an exchange. Right. And so, you know, that type of stuff is what we're up against a lot. And mm-hmm. really, you know, sort of to toot our horn. I mean, Tom and I, you know, we got into this business. We were blessed to have a mentor, one of our father's friends that had an exchange company. It was one of the biggest, the first in the industry. And you know, that guy really, you know, taught us the ropes, taught us how to do stuff. And you know, we've expanded well beyond wherever that was at that time. But, you know, that swap thing, people hear about an exchange, they think it's got to be a swap. And we're really, if you think of us, just think of us from the context of you're paying us a fee to take your sale and purchase and turn it into an exchange. But we can only do that if you engage us before closing happens. And
I see,
you know, in one of those things, it's like, as far as selecting an accommodator, you're going to want to look at, you know, how long they've been in business. I thought Tom was going to say, you know, the number of clients or potential clients that we talk to that are working with other companies where they're not getting answers. Mm-hmm. Because what's happened is when we got into this business, the only people who were in this business were people that understood it. They were broker people that had lots of vast, you know, background in investment real estate, or there were tax or legal people that understood it all. And when 91 happened and the guidelines came down, now all of a sudden you got big companies that just hire clerical people to basically hold the money. And Tom and I like to say, we do more than just hold your money. I mean, yeah. You want to have somebody that's going to, you know, things can go sideways in an exchange. And it's not one of those things. Really, it's a question whether you can or can't do something. It's how you're going to do it. And so it's really critical that when you're shopping for an exchange company, sure, price is important. But, you know, if you're having brain surgery, you're going to get the cheapest guy, or you're going to get the one that does it right. So ask questions about their history. Ask questions, yeah. You know, what's going on. And, you know, just pay attention to the level of knowledge of the people you're working with, because you know, an example would be, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, Tom had to, you know, clean up a transaction where, you know, somebody had multiple down legs selling, and one of those down legs blew up. And so the purchase was happening too, real tight. And we had to change the format of the transaction from a basic delayed exchange where both sell and the purchase happened, to a blended transaction, which mm-hmm. means we're combining a delayed exchange and a reverse exchange into one transaction. Now, that's two different, in effect, exchanges, and it has to be done before the purchase happens. Otherwise, we just gave them the new property with one, and we can't go into it from the second one. Right. If you're not working with an exchange company that's capable of doing that, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, so the expertise for tax implications really plays a big role in what you guys do.
Definitely. And as Tom said, we work with the tax and legal community day in, day out, because yeah. You know, the reality is this is what we do, right? So if somebody comes in, we want to know what they've got, where they want to go with it, you know, what their ultimate objectives are. And we're going to, if we see a problem, we're going to arm them with information. We're going to say, okay, hey, this is our concern. This is the mm-hmm. information that supports what's going on. Throw it in front of your tax people or legal people. See how they feel about it. They like it, great. If they don't like it, don't do it, or get new tax or legal people, right? Or have them call mm-hmm. us up and we'll talk about it.
Great. Well, let's go back to that call. If somebody is if a seller is considering selling, but they haven't put on the market yet, say later this year, what would be a model for how that phone call would look like to you, and what questions could they ask you to get started and organized the right way?
Yeah. That's a good question. We went over just in one of our training meetings yesterday, went over some of the questions that we ask, because a lot of times people will call us up and they won't know first off if their property qualifies. They won't know if the exchange is something that might benefit them or not.
And I see.
They don't oftentimes do much in the way of planning and talking to their accountants when they're at the point where they're calling us. So
right.
we generally will want to find out first off, you know, what is this property for you currently? Mm-hmm. What's the use of the property? Is it your primary residence, or is it something different? If it's something different than your primary, then chances are it's something that you can't exchange. Okay. Even if it's your primary, you might have situations where part of that property can be exchanged as well. We deal with mixed use properties all the time where somebody's selling a primary residence and they may have well over their allotted Section 121 capital gains exclusion mm-hmm. for personal residence. And they can oftentimes defer the remainder of their capital gains taxes through a 1031 exchange if they've been treating a part of that property as investment property, or if they are selling a property within 3 years of moving out of it, then they can oftentimes utilize both Section 121 and Section 1031. So what's the property being used for?
You know, right.
Tell us whether or not it's exchangeable. And then we want to find out, do they have a gain? Do they know what their basis is in that property? Oftentimes, again, something that they don't know. A lot of times people think that their gain is just simply how much cash they're getting out of their sale. And you know, that's not what gets taxed. The cash coming out is not what gets taxed. It's your gain. So we will go through, if they don't know these things, if they don't know what their basis is, and we'll go through some hypotheticals, we'll get some numbers from them. You know, how long ago did they buy the property? Is it improved property or is it bare land? What's the property selling for now? And so there's a string of questions that we'll ask them, and then we can usually get a pretty good idea.
Yeah,
and letting them know what sort of tax exposure they may have on that particular transaction. We don't know what else has gone on in their life, of course, so we can't tell them if they're going to have taxes or not. But as far as if we're only looking at that transaction, we get a good idea of whether or not they're going to exchange. And then, if it's going to benefit them, if they know what they're going to go into already, then we can tell them if that's going to benefit mm-hmm. them as well.
So if they have experience or they're experts, they can start with this information and just tell you this. Or on the other hand, if they're brand new, they can even just call you and say, I don't even know what to ask you. Can you just start?
Absolutely. Yeah. We've been doing this long enough where, you know, we don't know all the answers, of course, but if we don't have the answer, we know where to get it. And that's,
yeah.
I think that we know the questions to ask people. If they don't know the questions that they should be asking us, we know the questions that they should be asking us, and we know what questions to ask them.
And just make sure that they call you and ask you before they sell to stay out of trouble.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
People will always ask us when they should be contacting us. They'll call us up and okay, I've got this property. I'm thinking about listing it. When should I call you? And the first thing I'll tell them is anytime you've got questions. Second thing is as soon as you have an agreed upon offer, you've got an accepted offer on your property, it's going to escrow, contact us. We'll need to get all of their contact information. We'll need to get all the contact information for the escrow company or attorney that's closing that transaction so that we can provide them with all the documents and instructions for that sale.
That makes a lot of sense. It's always a good time to plan well.
Oh, yeah. You can never do enough planning.
Well, we can certainly talk for a long time. We got one more question for you guys if you have time.
Sure.
And with the Pacific Northwest and the legislation happening in Oregon and Washington, in that context, or just the changing world we live in, are you seeing more sellers either switch property types or switch locations of properties or both in the last couple of few years?
Tom, you went through numbers recently on the percent of our transactions that are closing in the Northwest, right?
Yeah. So the short answer to your question is absolutely yes. We're seeing more people that are relocating. And if they're not doing so themselves, a lot of times they're relocating their investments.
Okay.
And I know you guys have offices in Oregon and Arizona, and Arizona's always been a hot spot for people all over the West Coast anyway, moving to. And I'm sure you're seeing more and more investors from other areas as well.
Yep.
But this past year, I think we ended up with somewhere around, maybe around 35 or 40% or so of the transactions that we started were closing in the Pacific Northwest, and only about 25% of the closings on their acquisition side were happening here.
That's a big number.
Yeah, we do a lot of stuff all over the East Coast as well, but the Pacific Northwest, because we've been here so long, is where most of our stuff happens here in California. But yeah, we see people moving into more tax friendly areas. People work hard for their money, and they're just they're losing it to too many state and local taxes this time. So they're looking to places like Arizona and Texas and Florida. And a lot of the people here, we had more people moving in their investments into Texas this year than we've ever seen. On the East Coast, where we used to have people who sold in New York and New Jersey, they were usually reinvesting in those areas again. A good majority of those were going down to Florida.
Interesting. And are people switching property types too? I know you guys have done a lot of information on DSTs, for example. Are more people switching from their standard of, apartments, for example? And in the past, they would sell apartments and buy apartments. Are seeing more people switch property types?
Yeah, I mean, Tom can follow up on this, but I think one of the fundamental changes we've seen, Bernie, is that the DST market, it used to be people it was sort of the backdoor to deferral, meaning if they couldn't find what they really wanted, they went that way. And, Tom, we had one transaction last year that was like $30 million down leg. And historically, maybe, the residual little million or whatever left would have gone that way. And the entire pool went into it.
Okay.
So, before we got started on this, we were sort of talking about a fundamental shift of ownership from regional to mom and pops to the institutional ownership. And it's happened for a variety of reasons. But, if you just look at the proposals of the state, the state of Oregon right now, the proposals with the rent control that they're happening and the proposals of Multnomah County adding the additional capital gains tax, there's not a state in the union right now that does not honor 1031. There were states that didn't. I mean, Pennsylvania was the last one. But they figured out pretty quick. It's like, look, if you're going to charge a tax, investors don't have to buy there. They're not
going to. Right.
And our regional, politicians, but all of them, they need to understand that taxpayers don't have to stick around and sit there. So the institutional ownership changes not only the ability of rent control to do anything, because Wall Street doesn't care, but it takes the ownership, the money, everything from a regional level and puts it elsewhere. And ultimately, it goes backwards on them. And Tom and I have been doing this for over 30 years. And, you think about was it the late 90s, Tom, when Oregon, we had the one client that sued the state because they discriminated between residents and non-residents on the tax deferral. What had happened is one of our clients had gotten dinged on a state level because he was a non-resident, and his lawyers were smart enough to come back and sue the state and say, look, you know, the Oregon State Constitution prohibits discrimination between residents and non-residents. And they ended up overturning it. And the state's response was, well, we're just going to make it fully taxable for anybody to exchange out of the state. And fortunately, the real estate industry jumped on it and said, no, you can't do that. Nobody's going to buy here. So they overturned it. Mm-hmm. But with that said, you'll understand that, as Tom said, we've got so much money going from here to states with either more friendly positions on ownership and rent control or no state tax. Don't think that you can exchange out of the state of Oregon and into, let's say, even Washington State. I mean, and I know they just put some stuff in place with capital gains. Doesn't at the current moment apply to real property. But, historically, people would say, hey, gee, if I can exchange in Oregon, what? It's the highest state in the union tax-wise, short of New York, if you make $25 million, right? So it's as much as almost 14.6 or something top here. So don't think that you can exchange out of the state of Oregon into Nevada, Florida, Texas, whatever it is, and then hold that property a year or two and then sell it. And just sell and realize the gain and get rid of that tax obligation. Oregon's going to be able to claw back what was deferred out. Mm-hmm. California saw Oregon do it and did the same thing. So you really need to understand, what you're doing and laws change, and that's where you got to stay on top of what's happening. But I just spoke a little bit further than I probably should have on stuff. But Tom, you want to add anything?
Just as far as the DST investors, the other thing that we've seen change a little bit on those is the typical DST investor used to be, and if people don't know what that is, Delaware Statutory Trust, it allows for you to buy into a portfolio of properties with multiple other investors, similar to a REIT investment. It's the closest thing to a REIT you really have that qualifies for a 1031 because mm-hmm. you're buying real estate with a DST. And we see a lot more people who are not necessarily toward the end of their investment cycle. It used to be the case that we maybe have the older investor that they've managed the single multifamily properties and a lot of doors for years, and they're just tired of it and they're looking for something else. Now, I think especially with the times we're in, uneasy times, people are looking to really diversify and to get out of the management if they can. Mm-hmm. With the DST, you might take half your money and put it into a self-storage DST that, it might be in one state or it might be in a couple different states, usually in a no-income tax state. And then you might also put some into something like either multifamily or senior housing. And so it gives mm-hmm. People the latitude to go across different types of properties and in different states, and you get a lot of diversification. So we're getting more and more investors that are they're not at the end of their investment cycle. They're really looking at it as a better solution to give the more safety diversification. And you can buy into something that in the past was only allowed to institutional money.
Yeah, times are changing, I guess. Yeah. Well, thank you both for your time. There's so many layers to what you guys do. I learned today, and I could sit and talk with you for hours. So hopefully you guys will come back on again in the future and we can talk in more in depth on other topics. But thank you for your time. And that was a fantastic introduction to what you guys do.
Okay. Thank you very much for listening. If you like this episode and want to hear more, subscribe to our podcast where we release new episodes weekly. If you want more information about the multifamily market, go to my firm's website, josephbernard.net, click on the Contact Us page, and sign up for our apartment e-newsletter. As a bonus for listening to this podcast, I will answer any apartment investing in questions you may have via email at bgarrett@josephbernard.net.